Hey, good afternoon. I'm Kevin, and I'm one of the pastors here on Journey staff, and we are launching into a new venture with Jamie and Susie, and they're going to introduce themselves right now.
Hi, I'm Jamie.
Hi, I'm Susie.
Oh, you had so much more enthusiasm in that.
You could do better, guys.
Yeah, okay. Hi, I'm Jamie.
And Jamie, what do you do here?
I'm one of the pastors here.
Ah, and Susie?
I'm also one of the pastors here.
Well, we're so glad that you joined us.
Thank you.
We've been wanting to do this podcast for a while, and it is a podcast that is built off of some of the questions from our latest sermon series that we did called the Jesus the Storyteller. And we got a lot of questions, and we want to be doing this periodically. We're hoping to do it once a month. And
yeah, as we wrap up each series, if we could kind of have some time to reflect on what everybody is still wondering about or what's stirred within them. I think that's always been one of the goals at our church for a long time is there's no point in talking about. Sometimes I think in a church you're asking questions or you're giving answers to questions no one is asking.
Right.
And our goal has always been like, what are the questions we have? What are the things that are stirring within us? And let's talk about those things.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting, too, when you look at all the questions that were sent in, that it stirs up some really different questions in lots of people mm-hmm. in different areas of their faith and their life. And so that's an important thing to look at as the body, because when you hear something and God's speaking to a group of people, he may be saying different things to everyone that's for the benefit of the good.
Yeah, because let's remember, one of the things we value the most at our church is questions. Hmm. We value questions. Yeah. And I think one of the things I'd like to say off the top, this is our first podcast leaning into this, is we're not going to have all the answers.
Right.
And often you're going to hear us go, look, I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. This is how we interpret it. From our perspective, yeah. I wonder if, perhaps, maybe, because mm-hmm. we're all very much on a journey. We really could say, when we introduce ourselves, we say we're one of the pastors here, but we really could say we're one of the ministers here amongst a full body of believers.
Right.
We're one of many. We spend a little more time studying and teaching. That's part of our role, creating content and trying to really be sensitive to God and interpreting this content in light of our culture, in light of the context of our church. Mm-hmm. But we love the questions. We could have been asking the same ones.
Right.
You know, in our, from a certain perspective.
And we lean into the mystery of it a little bit more than most churches do.
Yeah.
So we're excited about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For some of us, the questions beget more questions.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. There is a opportunity to be to explore faith in a deeper, broader way, and allow God to be bigger than our box. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, may that box always be blown up. May we understand that there, with God, there really isn't a box. Mm-hmm. So the only box that exists in that metaphor is.
Right.
What we bring to it. And as soon as we talk about God, we're working from a box.
Right. So if we haven't had the opportunity, if you haven't had the opportunity to listen to any of the messages that prompted these questions, is rooted in the parables, right, Jamie?
Yes. Yeah. So you can go back to our podcast, Journey Frank. Well, now it's Journey
TN.
TN. Mm-hmm. .com. Or you can go on iTunes mm-hmm. and look up Journey Church, although there are lots of them. So you could also check Jamie George. Either one of those two things, if you go on iTunes, will get you there. But you'll just discover this whole last series was examining the stories of Jesus and the medium of storytelling. Why stories? Why didn't Jesus go, here's some doctrine, here's some dogma, take some notes?
Right.
Why did he give it in the ambiguity of story?
And we... in delivering these messages, kind of broke some of the stereotypical answers to some of the questions that we believe that they answered.
Yeah.
And long time tradition, and so you might listen to the message and be thrown off a little bit.
If you hear the story, we're attempting to retell Jesus' stories in light of the context in which they were told. Sometimes stories are reinterpreted from just purely from our Western culture or from a certain theological tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And we all come with our programming.
Right.
What we try to do is go, hey, if we stepped out of our programming, how we were trained to think or believe, and we really tried to approach this like a person who was hearing the story would approach it. So that means we're offering some Jewish context, some cultural context, some social political dynamic that's mm-hmm. at play. what if the stories were told in that, which we really believe they were,
yeah,
how could we revisit these stories?
Right.
So that was our attempt to interpret these stories in the best light that we understood from the framework in which they were told.
Right. And for us, and our hope was it would deconstruct a little bit.
Yeah.
Deconstruct for you a little bit of culture, but also deconstruct a little bit of your understanding of what it means to be in the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm. Because we all were given something, even if you're really, really new to faith.
Yeah.
You read an author, you heard a teacher or something a week ago or a month ago or a year ago. We build our frames from those who are our teachers, and our teachers are everywhere. There could be a podcast, could be an author, could be our Sunday school teacher, could be whatever. But there were some real patterns of thought that have existed in our country for the last 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you have like this neural pathway of thought that kind of gets ingrained. And our goal is to go, did the church actually believe this for hundreds of years, or is this relatively new thought?
Right.
Or, hey, was there a place along the way where some theologian wrote something, and then everything radically diverged at that point? So we can certainly look back in church history and see some of those things.
Definitely.
So let's ask great questions about how we came to these conclusions.
Yeah.
That's what we're attempting to do. Yeah.
This tension that we continually wrestle with. Do we see it with kingdom eyes? Do we not see it? Do we hear it? Do we experience it? And we've tried to help people move into a deeper understanding of what the kingdom of God is now.
I think it would also be really helpful for a definition of the kingdom for some people.
Okay. Do you want to start there? You want to start with what is the definition of the kingdom?
It motivates me. I'm 9 chapters into a 12 chapter book, and I just have to finish the line edit. But the book is called Into the Kingdom. It's a book that I've kind of been sitting on for a couple of years. But it was for me. It was my journey into an understanding of what you just said, Kevin. The kingdom is now and not. It's not just a not yet. It's also a now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you look at Jesus' teachings, you see that there's this overwhelming sense that he's bringing it into the now. It's not that there isn't something related to the afterlife, but we're doing life right here, right now, and he keeps bringing attention to that. And these stories, I think, reflect that over and over again. So you could look at a kingdom a couple different ways. But a general definition for kingdom would be kind of the sphere of influence that is within your grasp. Mm-hmm. So like Jamie's kingdom might relate to my home, might relate to me taking care of my family financially. It's kind of what's within my arm's reach. These are the things that I can affect in my sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a traditional historical term of kingdom, you know, a king was overseeing his kingdom. He might expand his kingdom by conquering other lands, that sort of thing. So this was where the term kingdom comes from. Jesus starts using this term, and he immediately begins subversively to try and help people understand this is probably not what you think it is.
Yep.
You're thinking a king is going to come. You're thinking a Messiah is going to rescue you and set up a kingdom on the earth, overthrow the Romans, and make the Jews a state again in which he is ruling. And, of course, Jesus is saying, no.
He had to deconstruct that.
He did.
Yeah.
That's what those stories were doing.
Yeah.
No, it's so much more than that. So one of the phrases that I use for kingdom that's been really helpful for me is to think of it as an alternate reality, another dimensional plane. I think when you hear stories like the Chronicles of Narnia and others, those are helpful metaphors to pull us into. What if there was this other way of living in the here and now? Jesus, I think, is saying there is another way of living. It's my way. Mm-hmm. And you can access the kingdom by aligning with me. So if you can align with Christ, there's different terms for that, abide in Christ. Eventually, he talks about the Spirit coming to indwell us. So if the Spirit will reside in you, if you will listen to the guidance of the Spirit, this is how you will align with this other dimensional reality and live in the Jesus way, live in Christ's way, as opposed to the ways of, quote, the world,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a way of darkness, as opposed to the common path of default that people will live according to, built upon their own desires. And most of that is framed up in fear. So a phrase that came out of this, really a couple of our series, has been, are you living in fear, are you living in love? The way the kingdom is love, and the way outside of the kingdom is fear. And it's interesting, this is why we think Jesus' teachings on this have been so helpful, is in the last 5 minutes, I could have been living in a kingdom reality motivated by love, or completely away from the kingdom in my own darkness and blindness, mm-hmm. motivated by fear. And that's been really helpful for us as we consider what does it mean to live in the kingdom now.
Yeah, I think it's where we were supposed to live. It was what we were created for. We were created for the kingdom, mm-hmm. but we live in this reality, or almost false reality, that is the fallen world around us, and we engage it, and we've learned to adapt to it. We've learned to survive in it, that we've primarily become numb or blind to the kingdom that Jesus was talking about. But when we see it, it's like a flicker of light in the dark.
And that's why I think the darkness light metaphor comes up over and over again. And then yep. you get these characteristics of the kingdom wrapped up in peace,
mm-hmm.
in joy,
yep.
in love.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, we're not that far away from Advent, but these are some of the Advent words that are meant to bring hope. Hope is another Advent word that's meant to be this reminder that Christ has come to the earth, that we have an availability. It's within our grasp. We yep. can awaken to this reality called the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are in it, these are the kinds of things that show up. You find this joy that you can't really describe, and this peace that's beyond understanding.
And I think this next question helps us move and understand a little bit more of what the kingdom is. And somebody asked the question, does God's love have expectations attached to it? So when we receive God's love, mm-hmm. Susie, is there expectations then that God places on us to receive that love?
I think I would reframe the word expectation in the sense that it's not that God is putting expectations on us, but he has an expectancy of us as his beloved children. And so when we receive God's love and we're awakened to God's love, and again, like Jamie was saying, every day you have these choices to live in the kingdom and live in fear or live in love. And it's the same thing. Like I have a choice every day to respond to God's love in a certain way. And so I don't know that I would use the word expectation as much as I would as responses. So when we're awakened to the kingdom and we're awakened to love, our natural inclination is going, or our supernatural inclination is going to be to respond in such a way. So when we talk about peace and love and joy and hope, those things have outward expressions, and they usually are displayed in relationship to other people and serving other people. And we talked about one of the parables that we talked about had a lot to do with forgiveness and redemption. And so there is an action that takes place in a person's life to exercise the response of that they have towards the love of God.
Yeah, I actually think this question is rooted in the banquet, the great banquet,
mm-hmm.
of the idea that God invited all of these people to his mm-hmm. banquet, and I think his expectation was as they were going to come.
Well, I love the word invitation.
Okay.
Because that was one of the stories we told
right.
about the banquet. In my mind, it's going to the same place, Kevin.
Yeah.
Love carries with it by its nature an invitation, an ongoing invitation.
Yeah.
We all know this. When you go back to when you're in that pure love state, think about being with a child or with those early days of romance or whatever, like it kind of washes out of us. There's this ever-present invitation. Come jump into my arms. Come, let's have this moment of affection, or let me do this thing for you. Love carries invitation to it. Now, I think an important delineation is that every good and perfect thing comes from above. So while we've been given free will, the impetus for anything of value, anything that we might even call holy, anything that's good, the impetus of that comes from God. We're always closing the loop. So any even thought
yeah.
to go, I want to do something good. I want to participate in this love story. I didn't generate that in my darkness. It was generated by God's Spirit. It was generated out of those kingdom rhythms. So something within me created a compulsion. Now my free will is I can respond to the compulsion. So it's, we're back to kind of the word invitation. And I, now, and I, to me, that is what I love, that word expectancy. Now there is this expectancy that sits within me. You've been invited to this banquet. How would you not want to come?
Right.
I think that's where you're going. Like, who would not want to be a part of the kingdom way?
Right.
It's full of love and peace and joy and hope and redemption. And who, and yet in our darkness and in our blindness and all the way back to the garden, in our determination, in our pride that goes, I think I kind of have a better way to do this, God, than you do. Mm-hmm. We miss out on the invitation.
My struggle with the word of
Well, I was going to say, I think too, knowing our community too.
Yeah.
I mean, expectation and expectancy are two very different things. And knowing our community, there's a lot of us who grew up in traditions where there was a lot expected of us as believers.
Right.
And so that carries a lot of weight in how we exercise our faith. And so I would, if someone were here asking that question, I think I would ask the question of, well, are you thinking that God is requiring things of you? I mean, yes, he requires, he's asking for our obedience. He's asking us to surrender to him and to give our lives to him, but he doesn't need us. Hmm. God doesn't need us to bring about his purposes. God doesn't need us to rescue people. He's already done that. Mm-hmm. And I think for some of us, we were brought up with this, well, if you're a Christian, then you need to do this, this, and this on these days of the week and every year, whatever it is,
right,
based on your tradition. But I don't think that they're expectations in the sense of like he needs us to do things. It's like you said, the invitation is there for us to participate in this glorious thing that he's doing.
Right.
And one of the things that blows my mind about God is we can bring our religious systems and our functions of fear.
Yeah.
He's okay with that too. Meaning, hey, you're coming with the wrong motivation.
Right.
And I love you and I'm going to bless you anyway.
Right.
Now, it's not going to go well for you because that fear is actually going to create dis-ease inside. Eventually, it might even physically show up as disease. But it may leave you with anxiety. It may leave you stressed. It may leave you with regret. It may leave you with worry. So the ongoing invitation is like, you can live in that hell. At any point in time you want to give that up, you can enter the kingdom and experience this heavenly way of living.
Sure.
But I love you either way.
Yep.
And if you want to come with the fear, like, because I do think there are lots of people who have come to a church experience, and sometimes motivations are fear. And he goes, we can work with that.
Yeah.
And
he, sorry, go ahead. No, he just redeems all things.
Well, and when God loves us and blesses us, sometimes in the midst of that, because of that, he allows us to struggle and work it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the word expectation is loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And, but in, if God really loves us and God brings love and there is expectations attached to his love, I would think he would speak them out and say, here's my expectations that go with love. This is my expectation of you. It's like doing premarital counseling with somebody and say, hey, I have these expectations of you now that we got married. Well, it'd been nice to know before we got married. But there's, and that's the tricky part of this word, where grace has a tendency to lean into the idea of I have no expectations.
But it's such a great question, because if you grow up with an Old Testament understanding without a New Testament clarity,
right? Yeah.
Then you might go, well, the Old Testament's loaded with expectations.
Right.
I mean, there's law after law after law after law.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to address, when Jesus comes and talks about the law, he actually spends a lot of time quoting Old Testament scripture.
Sure.
What is he addressing when it comes to those previous expectations? Now, I have some thoughts on that, but I'm offering you guys that question. How would you, if somebody goes, well, I read the Old Testament, it seems like there's a lot of expectations. What would you say to that?
That's a good question.
Well, he says it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He pretty clearly says it, that it's all summed up in love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the summation of the law. Mm-hmm. But if you read the Old Testament law, there's a lot of things you shouldn't be doing. So the his expectation is, if you're going to follow me, you're not going to do these things.
So then
you're not going
to
lie.
I'm playing devil's advocate. I know. This is important because I love the fact that somebody asked this question. So is that an expectation? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul.
No.
Love your neighbor as yourself.
No, and that's where I think the difference between expectation and expectant comes in, because love is not something that you can just...
It's not contingent on that.
Right. And you can't also, like, if Jesus is telling us to love, we all know, especially now in this day and age, you cannot conjure up love. You can't just...
force it.
No. Yeah. Uh-uh.
Well, I mean, I think the most, where I'm going with the summation of the law, I mean, Kevin, you and I were just in Israel, so every doorway has that summation of the law and a mezuzah on the door.
Yeah.
So, you know, the hang it on your doorpost, like that's for Jewish people, that's not just metaphorical. Mm-hmm. This is literal.
Yeah.
And it's a reminder of this great, important truth. And of course, I think we would all agree, knowing you guys, we'd all agree it is a great, important truth. But that quote expectation, love the Lord your God, love the Lord with all your heart, mind, and soul, love your neighbor as yourself. I think what we're saying collectively in response to someone who's asking this question is, this is a calling and it's an invitation, and we're going to benefit from it if we follow obediently that instruction. But expectation is the wrong word, because expectation negates grace and love.
Right.
I think what we're trying to say is, God's going to love you whether you fulfill it or not. That's his nature.
So that leads into the next question pretty well. It leads into this idea of, we talked about Jesus disrupting the system. And that was a big part of, we talked about it briefly, just the deconstruction of what was going on at that time. What does this mean for Christ followers in our local context today? So I think it moves from an expectation to, okay, so what does that mean for us?
Yeah.
And then how should we engage with social justice initiatives in our community and nation? Although we are not loved by the divine because of our behavior, but is engagement with social justice part of our calling as lovers of the divine?
Yeah.
So it moves to a place of, I think we're definitely invited into that.
Yeah.
And I think God is a God of justice. And he was attracted to those that were marginalized, under-resourced, however we want to say that. And found his the most receptive audience in that community.
Yeah. And really announces the beginning of his ministry in Nazareth, his hometown. And after he announces it, they try to throw him off the cliff and kill him.
Yeah.
So it's obviously pretty provocative. But he announces his ministry as saying, I've come to bring healing and to bring help for those who are being oppressed. So clearly, social justice is at the heart of what we understand about our faith. And I
how do you make that connection with the kingdom?
Connected to love.
I think that's how do we see the kingdom in light of social justice?
The compulsion of functioning in the kingdom is, you can't help but have compassion for those who are oppressed and in need. If you're in the kingdom and you're connected to that rhythm, so it'd be another way of saying it would be to see through the eyes of God, or to feel the heart of God. When you're in that space, you can't help but have compassion and empathy for someone who's being oppressed, for someone who's being beaten down, for someone who's under-resourced, or someone who's in need. It pulls the eyes off of yourself and immediately allows you to see others. And so to me, that's a very natural rhythm of the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And we are called to participate in bringing healing and encountering that oppression. Now, the question, I think, becomes, especially in a vitriolic, politically charged era like we're in right now, is how? What does that look like for me? And I think what's most important, we're sometimes really well-meaning followers of Jesus get so passionate about a specific thing that they then create a formula, or they create a mandate that is really perhaps just for them.
Yeah.
And they say it's for everyone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So to me, Robert McKee is a guy who writes a lot about story. Yeah. And he talks about form and not formula. So to me, the form here would be, hey, we're meant to reach out to those who are being oppressed. We're meant to help be their advocate. That's this is form. This is a basic element of what it means to be in the kingdom.
Yeah.
A formula would mean I sell everything I own and I move into the inner city. Mm-hmm. I get a teaching certificate and I take a job as an English teacher at a school where kids are not being educated.
And everybody should do that.
Right.
Formula would mean this is what we all have to do.
Right.
And it might be what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
And that's the one thing where we get hung up, I think, a little bit, is we start to turn it into formula, and then we're just creating another version of a religious system. Mm-hmm. We've just picked our own thing that we believe everybody should be a part of. There's such a fine line.
Sure.
Yes, be passionate for the oppressed and understand that the most powerful thing we can do for them is to pray, is to intercede, is to bring our attention to it and carry it before God in prayer,
right.
Which might be a whole other podcast because, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the metaphor for me is energy in prayer. I literally picture that interceding is sending an energetic form towards someone.
Right.
I don't get it all, but that's helped me go, I'm actually contributing to altering their state of being through my prayer.
Right.
So praying is unbelievably powerful. It's not cliche. It's not, hey, I'll pray for you. No, there's something to it. But getting lost, unfortunately, and turning into formula is where we just create one more problem in the politically charged system.
Right.
And unfortunately, we get fundamental and vitriolic, and we become the very thing we're against if we're not careful, because we become violent in our language, in our tone, in our energy, full of rage and aggression, because we are, quote, standing up for Jesus. And I don't think Jesus needs us to, quote, stand up for him.
Right. I think the invitation into understanding the plight of people moves the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the opportunity to help with somebody in great need, either we do it out of obligation, we do it out of compulsion, we do it out of, or our heart is moved in a way that it comes from a place of love and compassion.
The hook phrase for me on that is, do I have to? The hook phrase for me on that is, do I have to or do I want to?
Right.
Or do I get to?
Yeah, or do I get to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
And the flip side of all that, then, when does the believer or the follower of Christ come to a place of where does generosity play in that? Where does the heart of motivation in your mind play a part in this idea of social justice?
Well, one of the things I thought about when you were talking, Jamie, is that the first thing I have to go back to is that I'm following a king of the kingdom. There is a king who came and announced what he was about and what he was going to do and invited us into this kingdom work with him.
Yeah.
So it's really easy for us to give into formulas when we're not looking to the king of the kingdom for what it is that we're supposed to do. You know, I mean, you could take adoption, for example. There are people who can get so fired up and passionate about adoption and what James 1 says about caring for orphans and widows. And like, we all just need to solve the orphan crisis and everybody needs to take in a foster kid and everybody needs to adopt. And while there is a great need for that and we need more and more people to do that, not everybody is going to be called to adopt. But even though you're not called to adopt, there is still the invitation to care for orphans and widows in their distress. So I do have a part to play in that. But what is my part? I have to get my directive from the king himself. And so a lot of it comes down to my relationship with Jesus and how am I communing with him first, and how am I hearing from so him good, first, Susie. And how well do I know him and his heart? And I really believe that the first and primary invitation is to come and be with him. And I mean, he sent his son so that we could be with him. I was thinking about the law on the doorway when you're in Israel, and everybody's like kissing the law before they walk in the door. But the invitation was to walk in the door always. And so it's first and primarily to be with him and to know his heart in an intimate way. And then he will show you his heart for you and what your role is in that. And we see that kind of played out through scripture. We see it in Nehemiah when he's building the wall. Everybody had their place in the wall and their assignment for that particular endeavor. And it's the same for now. I mean, there are people who are called to speak out against racism in a way that I have no ability to because of my story or my privilege, what I've experienced. And then there are people who are called to invite others in to just hear those stories and to give them a platform for other people to hear. I mean, everybody has a role to play. And I think, you know, Jesus came in and announced what his purpose was. But even in the Old Testament, it talks about loving mercy, doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly. And I think that key is walking humbly, being aware of being a part of something that's bigger than just you, and what is your part to play in that, and where do you get those marching orders from?
What if all of us walked into this voting season with that in mind? I'm going to walk in and vote walking humbly. As I understand my convictions regarding a really, really baby nation called America.
Yeah, that was very clear in Israel.
Because it is a baby nation.
Right.
We'd be in Israel and they'd be like, well, that's only 500 years old. I mean, that's not worth talking about. We're like, okay. We were excited about like Civil War era stuff, you know, back home. Yeah. So we live in this baby nation. We happen to think America is a really great experiment. We happen to think that there are a number of elements of our country that were founded on some biblical principles. We're grateful for that. But we have this real clear recognition. I think most people, your average American, is going to go, there's all kinds of greed and all the things that come with any kind of worldly system.
Yeah.
I got to show up and vote as I understand the Spirit of God guiding me related to the principles that I hold dear.
Yeah.
And I walk humbly.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that I might feel differently 2 years from now and my neighbor might feel differently than I do right now.
Yeah.
And it's okay to have different perspectives. Walk humbly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a difference between in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about being poor in spirit and social justice. There is this... I've met a lot of wealthy people that are poor in spirit. They just don't understand the depth of their own need.
Mm.
And it's and so in the ministry to the least of these, the ministry to the marginalized, the ministry, there is a degree of which some very wealthy people are marginalized.
Mm. That's a great point. Yeah, the fact is... I mean, it's not accidental that Jesus used that. It's harder to, you know, get through the eye of a needle.
Mm-hmm.
It's putting a camel through an eye of a needle, of which we rode camels while we were there. We have no appreciation for that metaphor as well.
No, thank you.
he could have actually added the metaphor of smell with that as well to just really make that metaphor pop. But that, yeah, for a rich man, it's hard to enter the kingdom because it's easier to rely on taking care of yourself.
It's the humility thing. Yeah. It's the, I need God. I need relationship with God. And if we're not careful, all of us in America, to some degree,
truly
fall into this category of, I don't have a lot of need. I have a lot of wants.
Yeah.
And we put God in the category of whether he's good or not based upon him fulfilling my wants.
Right.
And because our needs are more than met. So I think there is a ongoing struggle for the American believer, follower, of that line to walk.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the more you have, whether it's power, influence, money, it's easy to confuse whose kingdom you really want to be about.
Yeah.
And that's the human struggle.
Yeah. And I think the more you have, the harder it is mm-hmm. to see the kingdom.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, the is why, kingdom. And I think it's why Jesus says the poor will always be with you.
Yeah.
We actually need each other.
Yeah.
Because when you're under-resourced, you go, I don't really want to be here.
Right.
I'm very clear that I'm in need. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking for help naturally. If you feel like you got everything on lockdown, you got plenty, and maybe you're even, maybe legitimately, you're just in a good place and you're ready to give to somebody, they remind you of need.
Yeah.
You're serving someone in need and they're reminding you of the significance of need. There's actually a gift. And how many times have you sat with someone who was in need and they just had this, they either had a story that inspired you or they had some kind of mantra that they hung on to that inspired you, or you sat with them and you observed their joy in the midst of their need, and that inspired you. So to kind of summarize this idea of social justice and in the culture we're currently in the political context we're in, what does this mean? It means we're meant to serve one another, and it is a one another. Mm-hmm. We are each served when we give, and we give generously.
This kind of builds on that, and it moves us into more perspective on the parables. This next question is, Jesus was direct and caused stir among the rules of the era by challenging the rules. How can we place in perspective Jesus' parables teachings in today's polarized, divided society to find unity? Because it is what Jesus prayed for. I mean, you read that John 20 passage and you go, ooh, he's praying for unity. Mm. And it is one of the great, and we were talking about this a little bit at lunch today, is the uniqueness of the unity that we're experiencing right now. And to find that unity, we can't ignore what is going on in our daily lives outside of the church. So it's not just a church question. It's a cultural question. Mm-hmm. It's bigger than that. So how do we, as we're affected by these stories of Jesus, lean into this idea of finding unity in such a polarized society?
I think you did such a great job when we first started coming to Journey. You did a series. It was right before
the presidential election. That's right.
And you had like a really funny title for the series about, do you remember what it was?
No.
I do remember. What to do when you
that
had
was
to
2016.
And
half of my brain was working like, at that time.
That was a
but
bad
it was
year.
Such a good, it was such a good series because, and it was one of the things that really kind of solidified my heart's commitment to this community, was because you did such a great job of staying above the fray. You know, I mean, you definitely talked about the issues at hand and the weight of the season,
but didn't endorse anybody.
But you didn't endorse anybody. And if I remember correctly, you got some bad emails about that.
Yeah, we had people left because they were upset that I didn't pick
to endorse
on both sides.
On both sides,
yeah. Yeah, that was interesting.
But you really, I mean, I remember that series. You really did make that series about the kingdom and about what believers might want to be focused on, regardless of the circumstances or the
I think identity people. Comes into play here. I think identity of who we are oftentimes. I got myself in trouble really early on here at Journey when I spoke at one of our leadership summits. Mm-hmm. And I said, some of the most angry people I know are the people that watch Fox News. And
you got in trouble for that?
Well, he was not an equal offender.
I thought
he would have countered it, yes.
Or
yeah.
whatever. But I on purpose, speaking to the audience, was like, look, If we're so identified with one side or the other, we're going to get angry. And anger is a good indicator of the condition of the heart. Mm-hmm. It is what is, it's the overflow. It's that moment. Yeah. Okay. What's overflowing on me and why is it overflowing out of me? What is it that's causing me to be angry? And we stop seeing people and we start seeing political figures. Mm-hmm. We start seeing parties.
We dehumanize. Yeah. We dehumanize quickly. But again, the counterpoint to that is people will say, but aren't we supposed to get angry? Isn't there a righteous indignation to what's happening and the things people say? And And so you often see people physically reacting if you use a political figure's name, or if you reference a political party, or if you say Fox News or CNN or Huffington Post. Like, you can, all you got to do, truthfully, all you got to do is say any of those three.
Right.
And you'll immediately have a reaction from someone one way or another. They all, because we give meaning to words, we give meaning to phrases, we attach something to that.
Yeah.
And I think for those who go, well, no, aren't we meant to have righteous indignation? What would you say to them? Because you're going to have those who are listening who go, but aren't we supposed to be angry? Be angry and sin not. Isn't that like a thing? Aren't we supposed to be, like, somebody's got to get angry for...
You're legitimately asking.
I am asking because I know someone is asking. Now, I have an answer in my head.
Yeah. And I would say there's a difference between being, having in a righteous anger and being angry because you've been drawn into an ideology that is counter to peace, that is counter to unity.
I like that.
And there is you're being angry about the wrong thing and at the wrong thing. Because oftentimes we direct our anger not at issues or not at problems. We direct our anger at the people that are calling themselves a different label.
Yes, that's really good. Kevin, I love that word ideology. And to me, that's the check-in. So somebody goes, hey, am I not supposed to have righteous indignation? Sure. Have righteous indignation toward what you perceive to be oppression.
Yeah.
And it is, some of it's perception, and you might have good evidence and go, no, it's more than perception, it's reality, here's some hard facts. Okay, fine, great. But let's remember, the anger is toward the oppression, and let's recognize that people are real people, and we have to understand some people, because I know people on both sides of the aisle who are sweet people who genuinely believe with all their heart they're following the will of God.
Yeah.
And so how do we somehow walk with humility and compassion for people who see the world differently? My answer to the first thing that came to mind when you asked this question, by the way, the name of that series was called Allegiance, but there were some interesting titles in the, think in that. Yes. but that was the podcast series. To me, it's unity and not uniformity.
Mm-hmm.
It's unity and not uniformity. Isn't it interesting? The very first thing that God asked Adam to do was to give different names to the different animals. Different.
Yeah. Different.
Mm-hmm. It was creative from the onset.
Yeah.
And each of these names meant something, different meanings, this level of creativity and creation. Well, human beings have all this variety and all this flavor, and let's embrace that. Yeah. And enjoy that flavor. At times it's going to rub up against one another. And then ask why. And that's where, you know, my friend Ted all the time says, man, when your ego gets tweaked, the first question to ask is not what the other person's problem is. Check in and go, why?
Yeah.
Because you just had an opportunity there. There's a salvation moment for you. Yeah. I mean, every time your ego gets tweaked, go, what's going on?
Yeah. And I know this struggle is going to go on. This struggle is going to go on, but if we as people in seeking of the kingdom don't move towards the people that we find we're opposed to, there's never going to be any unity in it. If we don't move towards them and constantly demonize them and hold our hand out and stiff arm them, I don't know where you find unity in that.
No, and again, this is where some people feel very specifically called to issues that are close to their heart that happen to be political, right?
Right.
So perhaps a political party has politicized something.
Yeah, like pro-life is one of them. Yeah.
Pro-life, immigration, pick something.
Yeah.
That someone goes, I'm really passionate about, let's say, immigration. I'm really passionate about those people who are trying to find a better life.
Yeah.
Let's start right there.
Yeah.
And then they go, well, this party's politicized it this way, and this party's politicized it this way, both for their own gain.
Absolutely.
Okay, so it's become a political issue, but the truth is a heart issue for them.
Okay.
And we go, hey, we bless you and run with, like, God's, that is a passion thing for you. That's not accidental.
Right.
It's there probably to teach something about you, first of all, remember that. Secondly, go and do. Take responsibility for the thing you feel responsible for. Go.
Yeah.
Where we get lost is when, as a callback that we talked about earlier, everybody else should be doing what we're doing.
Right.
And we get angry with them for not doing it. And that's where, when we went through the season with the presidential election, and we had people who left because we did not pick a presidential candidate, or some of it was you didn't speak against a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. Again, both sides. Yeah. So I literally have families in my mind left because we didn't speak mm-hmm. for their preference. Though some churches, maybe they're called to that. That would be another podcast. But we're not. So one of the things we could say with great confidence is, if you need your church to pick a party or pick a political person, this is the wrong church for you. That's okay. There's lots of churches in town. We feel called to live in the tension because I want to be friends with the people who see differently than I do.
Right.
I want to learn from them. Yeah. Maybe they'll learn from me. Yeah. But I have so much to learn. I want to be with people who see the world through a different lens.
Yeah. Back to the immigration issue. In pastoring a church in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I encountered, after a short period of time of pastoring there, that I had several illegals coming to my church. They happened to be Hispanic. Until they have a real face, mm-hmm. until they have a real name, and they have real lives, and
you know the ramifications of what's going to happen.
It changes it.
Yeah.
Because you step into those real relationships, and so you go, well, I see why you're here.
Yeah.
Now my ideology is confronted with reality.
Yeah.
And the reality is trumping
yep.
my ideology.
And as a pastor of a couple of illegals, I have a little bit more freedom to feel that, as opposed to someone who's called to maintain a rule of law
yeah.
in a nation where the nation functions kind of on laws.
Yeah.
And how do you uphold them? And how do you tweak them? And where do you bend them? And how do you adjust them? And
yeah.
how do you have an amendment to that law so that, I mean, to me, those are the layers of complexity right. that begin so quickly.
So our adventure into that called us into, we have to figure out how to be advocates for illegals. Because they married people and they have kids here.
It becomes real. You get connected. Yeah.
It just, it's.
And maybe for someone that goes, hey, I don't get this person. Maybe for someone who goes, how do I connect with I've got a friend who's all fired up about whatever and I don't get it or I don't see it or
yeah.
we got a lot of arguments about it. Maybe a good action point would be go make it real for you.
Yeah.
Whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
Like go hang out with some refugees in Nashville and listen to their stories.
Yeah.
Be a part of it. We're on the immigration thing, but pick that.
Yeah.
Let's get to the abortion issue. Go sit with someone who's had an abortion and how does it feel for them
right.
when someone talks about abortion in an abstract way?
Yeah.
Or go listen to them and listen to them, their story about the fact that it's one of their greatest life regrets and what could have been done differently had they had different information as a teenager. Like, enter into the reality of it. Maybe that's the most important action to walk humbly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Remove it from an abstract ideology that's just a huge philosophical thing with no face to it.
Yeah.
Before you have any passion, make sure there's a face involved.
And I think that's huge. And if you don't know where to find a face, we can hook you up with Mission 615 and send you down to Nashville and you can sit with homeless every weekend.
Right.
I think too, going back to the issue of anger and the polarization of our society, I think when you think about anger being a mask of fear or woundedness too. I mean, in those moments when you're with somebody or a group of people or you might be actually judging them because of their anger or you might be feeling anger rising up in you, mm-hmm. you know, another point of action would be to check your heart and to you know, ask yourself, are you walking in fear or are you walking in love? Are you angry because you're afraid you're going to lose something? Are you going to lose a right? Are you going to lose a part of something that you've made your identity as an American Christian? Or, is there a fear or a wound from your, I mean, I'm an immigrant, you know, I came here as a young child and I fled a war. It was easy for me to come. I didn't have to come on a boat or anything like that. I mean, I got on a plane and I had money and all of that, but I still had to leave behind something.
Yeah.
And my life would be very different if I didn't leave that thing behind. But immigration stirs up something in me because of my story.
Sure.
So, you know, I think it's really important the question was about unity.
Yeah.
And the question was about depolarization. And so if we're going to be an advocate for that, if we're going to be reconcilers in the image of God, then we have to start with ourselves and ask, what is this stirring up in me? And why is my response this way?
Yeah.
Why am I, like you said earlier, why am I feeling this way? Or why might that person be feeling that way? And help kind of develop a little bit of compassion in yourself for that person.
You've got to give faces to it. If you're making blanket statements about groups of people.
Right.
And we all do it in some form or fashion. They're all like that. There is a generalization and a prejudice that is coming out of us, and we're lumping everyone together. And once they have faith, once you've placed relationship into the equation, it changes the prejudice.
The other thing is, typically there's a third way. We get caught in duality.
Yeah.
The certain the irony that I think can't be missed in immigration is that we're a nation of immigrants. Every one of us, except for our native brothers.
Yes.
The rest of us, man, we all got here through immigration.
Right.
So, but it, at the,
there
at
is
the,
such irony.
Yeah, there is. At the same time, there has to be rule of law. And if we just ignore rule of law, we
have
anarchy.
Borders.
So, no. Yeah. So, I mean, but let's look for the third way. Instead of saying to this wave of folks who are coming up from the South, hey, you know, no, you can't be, let's figure out a way.
Yeah.
Let's look for an alternative as opposed to a yes or no. Let's find a way because we value you and we recognize you have a desire like all of us to try and live a better
way. But they become political footballs.
Yeah,
they become, they lose their face. Mm-hmm. They become someone that we can lump into a group of people and say, we're for them or we're against them.
Yeah.
And
it was
never meant to be.
Which circles back to the nature of this question, which is how do we, like Jesus, how do we function in a subversive way? Here's how I think we do it. I think we do it by telling great stories. So, and I think the more we can tell stories on both sides, the more we can point and counterpoint, the more we basically allow people to enter into the tension and listen to the spirit. So we're just using immigration because it's just become an example for us. But this wave of immigrants that are moving up. Let's hear some of this. Somebody go find some of their stories. Let's go listen to some. And you know what's going to happen? We're going to feel some compassion for them.
Right.
But then let's also get some stories of those who are doing border patrol and those who live on the border in America who go, my livelihood, if we just go, hey, you 50,000, I don't know what the number is, however many people, hey, come on in, you can live in my city now. What happens to that city?
Right.
What are the ramifications of it being overrun? Let's listen to their stories. Or the person who went through a process that took them a year and a half to be an immigrant.
Right.
Listen to those stories. Listen to both stories.
All of them.
Let's tell great stories.
Yeah.
And let's look for ways for love to prevail.
Yeah.
Susie, back to what you said, fear almost always is rooted in a fear of loss or inadequacy. Mm-hmm. You can always bring them back. Do I feel inadequate or do I feel like I'm going to lose something?
Yeah.
So let's shift the energy. I'm not going to vote out of fear. I want to vote out of love.
Right.
I'm not going to tell stories out of fear. I want to tell stories motivated by love.
Yeah.
We feel like that was what Jesus presented us.
Yeah. Over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Repeatedly.
Okay. Let's take it out of culture and move it back to the church for a minute.
Yeah.
Because the next question and probably our last question is, what are some of the destructive ways that you've seen the parables used within Christianity, within the church? Some of the ways that the stories of Jesus are used to maybe shame or manipulate or tell. They were never meant to tell this part of the story that we create theology out of, that kind of idea, that people get a twisted view of God maybe. So, thoughts?
I was trained, and I think by well-meaning people, because I think they were trained the same way, but I was trained, there was a term that was used in the religious structure I grew up in called evangelism, and it was basically sales.
Yeah.
It was just a sales technique.
Evangelism explosion.
Yeah, there were a lot of different like little phrases like that.
Yeah.
But I felt a lot of pressure that and there were verses used like the Lord is the Lord of the harvest and the harvest is plenteous but laborers are few, and there were a lot of different verses that seemed to indicate that I was meant to pray a prayer with someone, because if they prayed a prayer a transaction would happen and they could have a secure afterlife.
Yes.
That was a lot of my upbringing was built, and there was a pressure. The pressure was for the quote lost person to have that transactional experience so their afterlife was secure. Correct. And the pressure was on me. And sometimes there were like numerical goals and other things to try and get people to do that.
Yep.
And so the pressure that I felt was, and there were even other verses that were used, like, if I didn't do it effectively, their blood was on my hands. This was a phrase that was used that was plucked out of a, I would say, it was misappropriated.
And a lot of really great skits made for youth groups. There were a lot of,
some that I was in. A lot of youth group sketches.
Yeah.
And again, well-meaning people who were just kind of living out how they'd been trained. I was one of them. I did some of that stuff.
I've delivered some of those sermons.
Mm-hmm. And because that's how we were taught.
Yeah.
And the pressure that I felt, but never felt right. I was always bucking against it. I mean, I remember having a pretty vehemently, like, I had a kind of a throwdown with a
growing
director.
Up in a Muslim home. And having to have those conversations over dinner.
Oh, my gosh. Which I love the fact that you brought that up, right? Because it's really the same thing.
Yeah.
In Islam, you're meant to go evangelize.
Yeah.
In Christianity, you're meant to go evangelize. And, of course, when we look back in our history, well, that's what the Crusades were all about, them fighting each other over that form of evangelization.
Literally
killing each other while evangelizing.
Yes.
Like, turn or burn.
Right.
Literally.
Which it kind of felt like that growing up.
Yeah. And we got the same kind of a phrase. It was just move to the afterlife. Instead of, I'm going to stab you, just so you know, you're going to burn in hell. Mm-hmm. And so I would say where some of those parables were misappropriated.
Was in that context.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. I felt a pressure. I felt manipulated. And it was the dominant motivation was fear.
Definitely.
And one of the things I heard a lot was, do you understand that if we don't do this, the church will cease to exist? Do you see what's happened in Europe? This is going to happen to America.
Right.
All those things. And by the way, the church may cease to be what it is in America. And I don't, you know, all the, and maybe, by the way, that's healthy. I don't know. But what I was told were they were all fear motivators of, and if I didn't play my part, then, and we didn't convert people to our way of thinking.
Right.
And so those stories were used, not motivated. This is not a blanket statement because I had very loving people in my background too. And I had some people that taught them differently. But the folks who taught them with the pressure was a motivation by fear.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, if you read your actual Bible, none of that's in there.
Yeah, that's the kind of a crazy thing about the transactional prayer. I do remember somebody asked me one time, like, hey, where's that actual prayer you're supposed to pray?
I remember the first time I kind of that whole thing started to get deconstructed for me. And we went to the Great Commission and it was, I don't even know who it was that I was listening to that was explaining the whole concept of making disciples. And they painted a totally different picture than the one that you just described.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not just about going and like the term witnessing or going and selling it.
Yeah.
To people,
close the deal, man. Get somebody to.
But making disciples and basically like telling them your story and everything that you know and bring them along with you was the picture that was painted. And it was so freeing to me because it was more, I felt like that was more so of who I was and how God's designed me. And it leaves the space for you to realize that it's really God who's the one who brings salvation. It's not us, and it's our job to go and tell the stories and to love the people.
It's much more of a sharing a life than selling a theology.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's so many things in the parables, especially when I was for the week that I got to teach when I was studying, and we talked about this a little bit, Kevin, you and I, that it's so easy to simplify what the parable is. It's so easy to simplify the meaning of it and try to decode it as though it's like a riddle or something. And I don't think God ever means to confuse us, but I think God definitely leaves us with a lot of mystery. Hmm. And so I think sometimes the damage with the parables, going to the original question, is that we can look at it and see it very simplistically, very black and white. Well, this means this, and there's the formula, and this is how I need to act. When there's often a richer message that Jesus is trying to convey to people through their context and through their normal common things that they experienced in life. Mm-hmm. But what he was really trying to convey to them was the heart, yeah, and his heart for them, and how how their hearts should in turn be transformed because of the invitation that they've received.
Right.
But
yeah, growing up, the story of the prodigal, mm-hmm, really only came to life to me when I read Keller's book on the prodigal God. Mm. And because it was always about me being that wayward kid.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yes.
Were you going to say something else?
Yes, I was. and missing the point, mm-hmm, missing the total point of the parable, because we have a tendency to label people with the parable. And really, the story's about God.
Yeah.
And
primary story. It's much better,
yeah,
with the title of The Loving Father, right?
Right. Yeah. Because it's but if you can't see the Father through the lens in which you're supposed to see the Father, which God really is, you just see, well, you're all a bunch of prodigals, or you're all a bunch of the older son, or you're, in reality, we're both of those things. We're all in, mm-hmm, those camps. And the beauty of that story is that the older son never goes into the party because, mm, he can't. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to. That's not beautiful. That's sad. But at the same time, it is the petition.
But it's a beautiful literary, yeah, feature. And I think part of it is learning how to read the Bible and recognize, yeah, the Bible is constantly creating these archetypes,
yeah,
to try and give us extreme pictures, personifications of our false self,
yeah,
to expose it.
Yeah.
Most of the time we need to be jarred, mm-hmm, loose. And a great story does that.
Yeah.
You know, when Nathan, who's a prophet, tells a story about the sheep to David and about stealing someone else's sheep, you know, he tells him this masterful tale.
Yeah.
And he just totally arouses David, you know, as a former shepherd, and then flips it and goes, yeah, by the way, thou art the man. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's great storytelling.
Right.
Because you subversively, you came around and you said, well, I'm going to tell you a story. And now David falls apart and repents because he just sees it so much clearer than if somebody just walked up in front of him and challenged him.
Well, and he sees his heart, because what his own heart. Yes. What follows is Psalm 51.
Yeah.
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 There's repentance.
That's what stories, yeah, do.
It is. And I think over time, what happens is we fall into... We don't read them fresh. We don't read them with new eyes, and we don't read, mm-hmm, them with kingdom eyes. And we end up just going, oh, yeah, I know the story, and I know how it ends. And
by default, it's a moral tale.
Yeah.
It's just a way to tweak my morality.
Right. And we miss the richness of the parables. And I think that's the bulk of the way that the parables have been misused. And even in what you were talking about a little while ago is, you know, watching news periodically, they'll quote the Bible, like, you know, do unto others, and they'll take these little snippets of
take a soundbite to reinforce their point,
right?
Yeah.
And then have some Christian leader tap into that and say, you know, post-Christian or post-modern or whatever it is, society needs to be reminded of these truths and of God and so forth. And the reality is that culturally, you know, you were talking about Europe, you're talking about America, we slip into this idea of, are we becoming a post-Christian society? Is Europe a post-Christian? I would argue that it's turned into a post-moral,
yeah,
culture, because Christianity merely presented itself in morality, not in true kingdom.
Yeah, and some of that morality is really helpful.
Oh, yeah.
And will help your country function better.
Right.
So it's not that that morality isn't good or isn't helpful or isn't healthy or isn't positive, right, but it's not the point.
Right.
And we've also given something up in the repression of desire and right. delight and pleasure and some of those other things.
Right.
So I agree with you. I think we're a society that's trying to figure out what does it mean to actually experience freedom and let our morality come not out of fear, but come out of love.
Mm-hmm. And there lies the tension, because in a culture that has decided that morality is situational, you got to say that's where we're at.
Sure.
It depends upon the situation as to what I'll do and what I won't do. And I think that alarms a lot of us. But in reality, what it does is allow the kingdom to be shining in light. When it really presents itself, you can see it, because it's so counter to what is.
Yeah. You get struck. There's no question. You have, it's those moments you have goosebumps or tears come to your eyes, or you can't help but chuckle. You see this moment where someone just displays the kingdom and you go, oh, there it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's becoming newsworthy in our culture.
Yeah.
So as we kind of put a bow on this, what is your hope? What is your desire for people as they engage the stories of Jesus? What is your hope?
What comes to mind for me is that we would have a bigger perspective of who God is. Because I think we tend to simplify things and look at things based on the linear and the circumstantial and what we're facing now and how things look now. And again, what God is inviting into is something that is much bigger than we could ever possibly wrap our minds around. Mm-hmm. And so I think my hope is that we would acknowledge that and be drawn into that and continue walking towards that.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, you know, we've talked a lot about this year, but I may talk about it for the next 25 years. because until I die, I know I'm going to be working on it.
Yeah.
It's so real for me in almost a visceral way daily is, am I making this decision out of fear or am I making this decision out of love? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of my hopes is that we'll, because I think, I really feel like that Jesus' teaching is driving us that way, trying to illuminate how much we get lost in the darkness of fear. And so that to me is just, boy, that's the center of the bullseye for me, is just to continue to walk around in that. Now, some of the medium for that is to, I hope some people will go back to the Gospels and read them, be drawn to them again, like, this kind of got stale, or I haven't read my Bible in a while, or this didn't make sense to me. I hope there'll be some people drawn to go back to Scripture and enjoy them, take them in, and let them speak to their hearts.
Yeah.
And then I hope this is a broader vision for Journey, but certainly something my heart's connected to, is that we'll raise up a whole new generation of storytellers who will, maybe unlike some of the generation that was before us that was really stuck on, their primary motivation was fear. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of reasons for that. They came through two world wars. I mean, there is no condemnation there.
Right.
That is their reality, what they came from. Yeah. And I don't. I have no judgment. I'm even in some of the weirdness and even in some of my abuse, it belonged and God has used it in my life. So there's no judgment for me.
Right.
But that maybe in our generation, could we raise up storytellers who are telling a different story?
Yeah.
That this is a love story, not a condemnation story.
Yeah.
And that the appeal, the draw is to awaken to the scandalous, profound love of God, as opposed to just God wringing his hands, generally not liking us, and that hopefully every now and then we could please him, which I think most people who I talk to grew up in a religious system, that was their general perception of God.
Yeah,
that would shift.
Yeah, just be good enough. That's good. I hope that they can read the parables with new eyes, with kingdom eyes, and say, okay, he told these stories to disrupt, to change perspective, to allow for a group of people, if they're willing, to see into the kingdom and see it in the way that he intended it to be seen and experienced.
And I think that's the way I've started to read the parables, is to read them through the lens of, wow, this was supposed to be totally different. Mm-hmm. And allow for the story to disrupt my normal mm-hmm. and my routine and jar me a little bit into the kingdom. I think that's,
yeah,
that's my hope for everybody.
Yeah.
So
good word.
Well, thanks, Jamie.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Susie.
Thank you.
You guys will be doing this again. We'll talk again in a month. Have a great month.